If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First of all, it's free, which for us is really important. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Emergency Docs. I'm Dr. R. Please note that the content of this episode does not constitute medical advice, but is purely for the purpose of education. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. Today, we're talking to Dr. Ethan Kunstadt. Dr. Kunstadt graduated with a BS in neuroscience from the University of Miami. He then went to medical school at the University of Alabama School of Medicine, and then went to residency at the University of California, Irvine. He currently practices emergency medicine in Orange County, California. So welcome, Dr. Kunstadt.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. This is my first podcast, so very much an honor and a pleasure to be here with you today.
So excited to talk to you today. This episode is going to focus on COVID fatigue and empathy fatigue. What is COVID fatigue, you may ask? Well, there's the medical definition, a real fatigue that one might experience after getting COVID, but we're going to talk about the more philosophical sense, the fatigue that we all have after having dealt with COVID for 2 years, that slight cringing feeling that occurs when you hear the word COVID or just outrightly shutting down conversations involving COVID and maybe even pretending it doesn't exist at all. But before we get into all that, tell me a little bit about your background. When did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
Sure. So I grew up in Mobile, Alabama. I actually was a candy striper when I was pretty young. I don't hear that term anymore. I don't know if they actually still use it, but I was volunteering in the hospital. My parents had a friend who was an emergency medicine physician in Mobile. And long story short, began shadowing with him probably when I was about 14 or 15 and just loved it from the get-go. And then kind of just stuck with that through school and medical school.
That's awesome. What were you doing as a candy striper?
It was like when I was probably 13,
Oh,
14. So
wow.
there was like pushing people in the hallways and nothing important. It was the emergency medicine shadowing that I think was when I found out that I wanted to do medicine.
Well, tell me more about that. When did you choose emergency medicine, or what made you choose emergency medicine?
One day I was like 14 years old and I had stitches in my back that needed to be removed. My parents said, "We'll bring you to this physician who's our friend in the ER and he'll remove them." And after that, he's like, "Let me show you around the ER for a bit." And we walked around and saw all these things happening, alarms going off and just a lot of excitement. I like the energy of it, the variability of what I was seeing just in that one day walking throughout the ER. So they said, "Come back, shadow me some time." And I did that pretty regularly throughout high school. And times were different then. I mean, I remember the quick paper charts. I remember people putting OG tubes in for alcohol intoxication. It was a different time for sure.
Yeah, I completely forgot about OG tubes for alcohol.
Yeah, it was intense. I mean, I distinctly to this day have a like vivid photographic memory of this patient that was just absolutely hating it. And it's funny to look back at it now, we give them Zofran and watch them,
Yeah. So I guess emergency medicine is something that you've known you wanted to go into for some time. Did you ever consider any other specialties, or was it emergency medicine 100% from the start?
It was pretty much emergency medicine from the start. When I went through clinicals in third year medical school, OB-GYN actually caught my eye for a little bit because of the procedures and the medicine that they practiced. I like surgery a little bit because of procedures, but that lifestyle was not for me. So ultimately, I mean, emergency medicine was what I wanted to do, and I stuck with that, most of medical school.
What's your favorite thing about emergency medicine?
Just the variability, just every day. I mean, not knowing what's going to happen. And everyone says that, but it is exciting to go to work. It's a little bit unsettling as well, but you just really don't know what's going to happen. Right now it's going to be mostly COVID, unfortunately, but
Yeah.
every single day is something different and something you can learn from.
So speaking of COVID, how have you been affected by the pandemic?
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, in so many different ways, that I think a lot of us, whether we're in medicine or not, are affected. You know, you and I finished residency not long before all of this, and I don't think we thought a year or so out from residency that we'd be in the middle of this pandemic that now going on the third year of, we're still in the middle of. It's tough. You're hearing all these different opinions from different people and not always knowing who to trust and what to think. And then your home life, some people have families they have to bring it home to and loved ones that they're scared to infect, and then they can't see them for a prolonged period. And then a surge happens and you don't want to see your family, and it goes on and on.
Yeah, I think that's a constant worry for me as well, where I don't want to bring it home to my family. And I think that's been the scariest part, because now that we have vaccines, I personally feel much safer doing the work in the emergency department, but we don't have vaccines for kids under 5. So I definitely worry about that.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, having a family at home, a young unvaccinated kid, or maybe some elderly that even is vaccinated, still worried about, is a challenge. And then on the contrary, you know, I live alone, and then you come home and no one's there to infect, but then there's no one to decompress and talk to you about what's going on at work. So it's kind of both sides.
That's definitely going to be one of the main topics for this episode, is talking about how physicians decompress or don't decompress. So let's get into that. We're planning to talk about COVID fatigue and empathy fatigue. And so you found a really interesting article on empathy fatigue published by Emily Sohn on Medscape. And the reference for this article should be in the podcast description if you're interested in reading it. In the article, Dr. Kaz Nelson states that compassion fatigue or empathy fatigue is just one reaction to feeling completely maxed out and overstressed. Anger at society is another response. So as clinicians, empathy is a critical aspect of the care that we provide. So how did you view clinical empathy prior to the pandemic compared to now, 2 years into pandemic?
It's a lot different now, unfortunately. It's been harder to do, mostly because of fatigue. But I mean, it's certainly a cornerstone of what we do. And if you don't have the ability to understand the patient in front of you, it's really, really difficult to provide effective care. You know, now versus then, I think it's really just the fatigue. And empathy is one of these things that slips away as you get more exhausted. Requires a lot of energy. And when that is wearing thin and we're moving quickly in a stressful environment, I think that's something that unfortunately a lot of us can start to forget about.
Yeah, you see that a lot in residents as well. I think there's been quite a bit of research published on medical students having very empathetic approaches to patients, being very excited about medicine. And then somehow during the process of residency, physicians tend to lose some of that empathy or experience more of this empathy fatigue. And so it's definitely not something that's new to COVID and happens anytime somebody's overworked or burned out. I think that the pandemic definitely highlights a lot of those issues.
Yeah, I agree. I think by medical school and residency, you've done 7, 8, 9 years of exhausting training where you feel like sometimes you're not appreciated and hard work that you're providing isn't good enough. And over time, that chips away at you. And I think maybe it's partially our own doing and just the rigorousness of the medical training system in general. But absolutely, it can literally see people getting a residency in the end and how they've changed. And it's unfortunate. And now COVID's only going to make that worse, you know. And I don't know if it's the emergency department alone where it's a pretty jaded environment and empathy might slip up even more, but certainly you see it amongst other specialties as well.
We've seen a lot of clinicians, doctors, nurses, techs post videos on social media, just kind of completely emotionally overwhelmed and frustrated and feeling helpless and hopeless. And so there are a lot of different mechanisms people use to cope, from just sort of going through the motions or completely dissociating and sort of viewing patients from a distant lens or maybe even not as human. So what sort of coping mechanisms have you observed in the emergency department or on social media over the last couple of years?
I mean, I agree. Like you said, there's a lot of social media posting about the frustrations and the exhaustion. And I think people just want to voice what they're feeling, and people feel better that way. And it's the natural way to, you know, to move on from something is, I guess, talk about what you're feeling. It's interesting to think about like how this pandemic would have played out if social media didn't exist. And that's a whole separate discussion, right? But in a way, it's good. It allows people to have a voice maybe that they wouldn't have, to people where they can express how they're feeling. And other times it can be, you know, not beneficial and can cause unrest and uncertainty.
We did an episode a while back with Dr. Sander van der Linden, who studies misinformation and particularly misinformation as it's proliferated on social media. And it's a topic that needs a lot more research, but I think we've really seen in medicine in particular how much misinformation can really affect patient care and empathy fatigue in physicians.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you work hard all day, you're around COVID, you come home or you log on to some social media and then you see someone kind of bashing what you're doing or the approach that you're taking. And it's frustrating because there's a lack of control in that. Like, I mean, I don't have a decision about how we're treating COVID right now. I'm just doing what we're told is the best thing to do based off the evidence that we have. But, you know, how do you reconcile working all day long and seeing it firsthand with a post saying it's not really that bad or not real? It's very stressful and hard to overcome.
In emergency medicine in particular, we get really used to seeing terrible things and then moving on from them really quickly. And in a recent episode, we discussed how most people can do this to a certain extent, but then you sort of reach like a critical point when there isn't enough of a break between those episodes of terrible thing, terrible thing, terrible thing. And then people get overwhelmed because there's no time to recover. Do you feel like you were prepared to cope with the pandemic because of your training in emergency medicine?
I think so. To some degree, in emergency medicine, as a provider, you have to compartmentalize things, or at least that's how it seems. And I don't think you can provide the sympathy or empathy to every patient when they're going through a hard time as you would maybe a loved one in a bad situation, because you don't have the energy for that. And there's just, you literally could not do the job if that level of sympathy or empathy was provided every patient every day. And that doesn't mean that can't come across that you empathize with them. But in terms of how you're really feeling at that moment, I do feel this sense of dissociating at times where you have six patients to see and they all don't want to be there. And you have to go room to room and talk to them about what's going on and provide compassion with the mask on when they can't see your face. And it's easy to just get in this sort of cycle of just running through it. And I don't know if I dehumanize the patient, but certainly you disconnect to make the job easier.
You brought up a couple of really good points, particularly with the mask, you know, having all of the PPE, the mask and maybe a shield, and patients can't really see our face. It's much more difficult to convey empathy and compassion through your facial expressions when people can't see your face and you can't see their face. So that in and of itself probably leads to a lot of this empathy fatigue because you don't get that feedback. You don't know that someone's understanding that you are trying to empathize with them. And then I think you also bring up a good point in that you can't take every patient home with you, not the literal sense, but the figurative sense. At some point, you have to find a way to dissociate and detach so that you can go home and continue to live a normal life and not be just debilitated sometimes by terrible things that we see or the horrible stories that we remember.
Right. Even at the beginning of being out of residency and being on my own, I would start to have this pattern of bringing stuff home with me mentally and, you know, run through cases again and think about, oh, did I do this wrong or did that wrong? And I was worn down. You know, I could not continue doing that. And I had to consciously make an effort to leave work and really try to not even start that thought process, because once it started, I couldn't stop it. So try to keep everything at work, not run cases over again and again in my mind. But yeah, and then with the mask thing again, I mean, I feel like I've certainly done a lot more sitting down at the bedside, a lot more hand on the shoulders, other ways to show it. But I mean, you really are lacking a lot with your face being covered in terms of showing compassion with the patient there.
In the article, Dr. Mona Massoud stated, "It's hard to have empathy for people who, for all intents and purposes, are very self-centered. We're at a place where we're having to choose between self-preservation and empathy." So that's a lot to unload there.
A lot of the focus in this article is about seeing patients who are unvaccinated come in, looking at that patient as something that's preventable, which is by and large very true. But as we're going through the Omicron surge and you're seeing people come in that are vaccinated, but you know have COVID and are frustrated and are mostly mildly sick, it now is moving on from just people that are unvaccinated to, you know, everybody with COVID now are all sick. But before COVID, I mean, we treated patients that would always have bad behaviors at home that would hurt them. And we didn't seem to hold it against them necessarily, or we didn't seem to. And maybe it's the sheer number now that's causing the frustration. But, you know, like a diabetic who continues to drink Coke in the waiting room, you know, it happens again and again.
Or the stage four lung cancer who continues to smoke, or like the extreme athlete who's broken pretty much every bone in their body and then they continue to go back out there and do more. Like, I mean, we're used to seeing patients who don't necessarily make the best decisions for their own health and their own care. But I think the point that you brought up is really critical to why we're seeing so much more of this empathy fatigue. The sheer numbers, those cases that we talked about are fairly rare, except for maybe diabetes. I think we see that pretty often. But part of what's been so hard about COVID is that many providers haven't had time to sort of recover their empathy before they have to see another case, and that can lead them to feel helpless.
One of the ways that we are protected in emergency medicine is that a lot of us don't work a ton of shifts relative to other physicians. You know, I work full time, 12 to 13 shifts a month. And now more than ever, I really try to make the best use of my off time, because I know the next shifts, it might, you know, be mentally exhausting or physically exhausting, and I need to decompress. And I think we all need to do that. You know, it's difficult if you're busy life at home with family and kids, but we need to be consciously aware of the stress that we're having and identify that, and then find ways to counteract it when we have the ability to not be at work, you know.
That's so important. And as clinicians who have gone through, like you said before, all of those years of training, we aren't necessarily the best at identifying what we need to do for self-care. And I think the pandemic has really highlighted some of those issues where when people are not at work, there has to be a way to decompress. There has to be a way to sort of rehabilitate yourself and your mental state so that you can go back to work ready with that empathy and with that compassion. So one thing that doctors have reported as stressful in this article are the number of critically ill young people they've seen, and the unvaccinated patients who request vaccination after it's too late and they're about to be intubated, and the patients with COVID who request medications like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine but refuse vaccination. And I find the last point really just paradoxical. I think it's hard for me to understand why patients request medications that are useless at best and harmful at worst, but think that vaccines are dangerous. So Dr. Heidi Erickson states that she's frustrated not by individual patients, but by a system that has allowed disinformation to proliferate. And I tend to really agree with that sentiment. This frustration can then lead to more of the burnout and empathy fatigue that we're talking about. So what pieces of misinformation have you encountered frequently, or do you want to debunk?
It's all the things that we continue to hear again and again. You know, the vaccines have side effects. I'm not going to be able to have kids one day. I need the ivermectin. I need the hydroxychloroquine. And all these things come up day in and day out where I work. And I honestly, at this point, just blow them off. I don't have the time with each patient to explain that they're being fed misinformation. But at the same time, to say that we're frustrated by people asking these things is, I think, showing lack of empathy, that we don't understand how they could feel or think this way. But in reality, it's just a product of what they're being given and shown on whatever media outlet. We have to understand that. We can blame the patient. That's easy to do. But there's a product of a problem that has a much deeper seed. And we have to understand that. And we can try to explain to them that, you know, they're wrong in a pathetic manner, which can be hard in a very impassioned patient. But we also need to understand where this is coming from. And that's potentially more important.
Dr. Vanderlinden had some good strategies for trying to get to the basis of misinformation. And he'd suggested asking a patient what their understanding is and just sort of asking questions to try to figure out where the information is coming from and what they're willing to hear. Because if they aren't willing to hear anything, then, I mean, the conversation probably isn't going to be effective. But starting by asking questions. And unfortunately, asking a lot of questions is something we don't necessarily always have time for in the emergency department. And so sometimes these conversations don't happen as often as they should, but something good to kind of keep in mind whenever we come across these types of issues.
Also, once people hear something, it is much, much harder to get them to unhear it. So you already have a losing battle kind of ahead of you with a short amount of time when they've spent who knows how many hours at home bored Googling these things in a rabbit hole of information. So you really got to be effective if you're going to try to address these things in the ER or in a clinical setting, but it's incredibly hard. And so I have found it in the past when I've tried, which is why I almost don't try as much as anymore, because I feel like I don't get somewhere that I want to get with a patient in that amount of time. But I think people need to try. We just need to find the best way to do it. And the first way is to probably remove, you know, the initial misinformation.
Yeah, I mean, people choose what information to believe and not believe. And so potentially, if you hear that something is incorrect enough times, it might help turn the tables in one direction versus the other. Hopefully, the side of truth and logic and science. But there's a lot of misinformation out there. And so sometimes it does kind of feel like a losing battle. So there's one article that you and I recently discussed, a second article surrounding long COVID. And so the reference for this also should be in the description if you're interested in reading it. It was reported by Medscape that healthcare workers are in the top three groups to report symptoms of long COVID. And we did an episode on long COVID previously, but could you briefly tell us a little bit about what long COVID is?
So there's actually not one formal definition or diagnostic criteria, but according to the CDC, long COVID or post-COVID conditions are a wide range of new, returning, or ongoing health problems people can experience 4 or more weeks after first being infected with the virus that causes COVID-19.
So it looked like this article reported the most common symptom was feeling weak or tired, and that was reported by over half of the survey participants. They also reported loss of smell, shortness of breath, muscle aches, sleep problems, and difficulty concentrating. I mean, based on those symptoms, I think every healthcare worker has had long COVID before COVID ever existed.
Basically every day for me.
Yeah. So what were the other groups in the top three besides healthcare workers?
So despite the article's title, healthcare workers were the third most likely to have the long COVID. The first were social care workers, which I guess are social workers. I don't think this is a UK. Second were teachers, interestingly, and then third were healthcare workers.
Yeah, I thought that title was a little misleading as well.
It says most likely are healthcare providers when it then goes on to say that we're third most likely, which is still not good, but you know, not the most.
And I think it's also important to note that these data are from the time of the Delta variant, not from Omicron. So it may be different with the different variants, but hard to say.
Right. At first, you would kind of think that this long COVID could be a sequelae of just severe COVID illness, like people that are in the ICU on ventilators. Yeah, I mean, those people get deconditioned and they have post-ICU syndrome. And is this just that? But actually, a lot of people that have mild symptoms that are never hospitalized go on to have long COVID. So we could definitely be seeing a surge after Omicron, even though it's not as severe a variant seems. It seems that you could still get long COVID from a less severe case.
Yeah, I mean, some people with long COVID never even experienced symptoms from their initial infection. So you can be completely asymptomatic with your initial infection and then weeks later start to experience chest pain or shortness of breath or fatigue or any number of those other symptoms. And so I think that's something that's been really misleading and not well discussed in the media, is that just if you don't end up hospitalized or you don't die from COVID, there are still a lot of other concerning issues that can happen.
Absolutely. I mean, if I were to go on to have chronic shortness of breath, my life would be impacted significantly. Everything I like doing, I wouldn't be able to do, or not to the same level. Yeah, it's really odd that people are having these symptoms despite having maybe no symptoms, right? And it's physiology of it is kind of odd. And it's just odd looking through, you know, I thought by 2 years into this thing, we'd have more evidence on this long COVID, because I haven't revisited this in a while until this morning, looking kind of back at up to date and other sources for long COVID information, but there's really not a lot on it. I mean, they tell you the symptoms and they say, you know, you can refer someone to, you know, a cardiologist or a pulmonologist, et cetera, but they don't know much. And I mean, hopefully we're still learning about it, but there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, several episodes ago, we spoke with the head of Long COVID Kids, an organization that was created to help support kids who are now suffering from long COVID. And she kind of said the same thing, that there's just not a lot of information out there and parents don't know where to go for resources. And there's not a lot of clinicians who are really specialized in treating these types of disorders. So it's something we can learn about, just like COVID-19 itself.
If we don't have a unified diagnostic criteria to define it, you can't even really diagnose it. So then how are you going to start treating it? I think the first thing is we need to have, what are the criteria to say you actually have long COVID, not just that you have fatigue after being in the ICU for a month or two, but we need to figure out what it really is and then put people into these categories of really having it or not, so we can study them more closely. It's difficult because a lot of it's subjective sort of stuff, right? I mean, are you going to do PFTs? Are you going to do pulmonary function tests in people that report shortness of breath? Or are you just saying anybody that reports shortness of breath 3 months from a COVID infection has long COVID? You know, so there's a lot of different ways to look at it.
Absolutely. Dr. David Strain, who is a senior clinical lecturer at the University of Exeter, had an interesting perspective. And in the article, he said, as we continue to see case numbers of Omicron rise, we must be wary that our reliance purely on hospitalizations and death as a measure of the risk from COVID could grossly underestimate the public health impact of our current COVID strategy. And so I thought this was interesting in that we do tend to focus so much on mortality and hospitalizations. But again, we rarely discuss the impacts of problems like long COVID and invest, like you were saying, the infrastructure in really learning, understanding, and defining it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, certainly initially in a pandemic with a virus we don't know, you're going to focus on death in hospitals. It makes the most sense. But we're seeing so many other ways to be affected by this, whether it's long COVID or getting COVID a second time and being out of work and then losing work from it, or people right now that are in the waiting room in busy ERs for non-COVID symptoms or things that are critical that are getting delays in treatment because, you know, the ERs are overrun with COVID cases, and there's a lot of different measures that we need to look at that can affect people directly or indirectly.
Absolutely. What is one thing you wish everyone knew about COVID-19?
It's a tough question. There's just so much. I mean, it's obviously an incredibly complex virus.
You can pick two or three if you need to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go on a rant here for a bit. But no, I mean, it's an incredibly complex virus. I mean, it has to be. We've never seen anything like this, really, it seems, in present, you know, in the last 100 years or so. And we're still going on. We're on year three. At times, it feels like we're in the same place we were, you know, at the beginning of 2020. It's a potentially deadly virus, but the vast majority of people are going to be okay. And there's a lot of hysteria that you can give into via different media outlets. And, you know, we're all at a point now in our mind where we're stressed out and tired of this. But the worst thing you can do is to get more bogged down in the hysteria and constant news about how bad it is, and just do what you can to protect yourself and get vaccinated, be healthy, and take care of yourself and your loved ones. And eventually this will hopefully move on.
Yeah, it's so hard, I think, to balance the hysteria with the apathy. And I think we're actually suffering from both right now, where there's still this like mass media cycle of constant discussion about how horrible things are. But there's also this growing apathy where people have just gotten so tired and so fed up at this point that they just kind of have the approach of, I don't care, whatever happens, happens, and I'm just going to do what I want.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, you're seeing articles right now with headlines saying, well, we're just going to move on and just live at this point. Okay, that's an interesting approach. I mean, some countries, I think, have tried that to some degree. But the news stories, we got to stop watching the news. You know, I go to my parents' house, the news is on at 6, it's on at 7, it's the same stories. And it just feeds into this fear. And I think a lot of the current surge in Omicron, where we're seeing ERs overrun with people with COVID that have, you know, mostly mild symptoms, it's a lot of it's like, I'm scared I have COVID. Like, I need to go to the ER, make sure I'm not going to die. And I don't blame that. I fortunately have not got COVID, which is incredible at this point. But if I got COVID, I would start being a little bit worried. I know what can happen to me in medicine. So if you're a layperson that gets COVID and all you hear is that you're going to die from it all day, you know, maybe you're going to go to the ER to get checked out.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of times there are patients who are actually negative for COVID, but come to the ER for testing because they know they've been exposed. And so then just by being in the emergency department, they potentially get exposed again. So I wish that there was a way to really help monitor the media cycle. Because if you think about 50 years ago or 70 years ago, there was one news program a day and everybody watched whatever channel they were going to watch, but it was on, you know, one time a day. And now there's a 24-hour news cycle. So there's a pressure for the media to continuously report something new or to keep reporting on something. And so some of that could have contributed to some of the hysteria that you were mentioning.
They're financially driven, I'm sure. I mean, they want to sell stories and they want the TV on their channel. So, I mean, you have to understand that context as well. But we just got to limit how much we consume, I think, at this point.
So what is a lesson you think we can take from this pandemic to prepare for future outbreaks and hopefully not more pandemics, but just in case?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, I think one thing in particular that I feel like we still haven't gotten right is testing. You see so many people, and I think you kind of just alluded to it, where people test negative for the virus when they clearly have COVID and they feel falsely reassured and they go on to go out that night and spread it to other people. But we're going on year three. I continually see people that test negative and have COVID. If we can't think of a system or have enough good tests to hand out to people in this country and we can't figure out who actually has COVID, how are we going to get over this thing? How are we going to have people isolate appropriately or not? But that is one of the more frustrating things, to see people come into the ER for maybe a confirmation test. Maybe they really need it, you know, because if your roommate has COVID and you have a cough and headache, shortness of breath, and you test negative on your home COVID test, probably still have COVID, but not everyone thinks that, you know?
I agree. I mean, there's definitely a lot of patients that I've seen where I think, okay, this one for sure has COVID, and then they test negative. And I'm like, I don't believe that. Maybe the swab wasn't high enough. NAERS are, you know, probably a false negative. But also thinking about that, understanding positive predictive values and negative predictive values, false positives and false negatives. We go to medical school, and I went to grad school before medical school. Those are really difficult concepts sometimes to fully understand, and how different tests have different abilities to find disease at different times during that disease. And that's really unclear to the general public right now, too. So maybe we should do an episode on that in the future.
Exactly. It's a really good point. I mean, like you said, the different tests have different periods that are going to be positive during the time course of the virus. People don't know this stuff, and they need to know, because otherwise they're going to have a false negative and not know it.
All right. Well, any final thoughts or anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up this episode?
No, just thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I think these kind of discussions need to occur more frequently in regards to everything, but also COVID in particular. You know, there's a lot of news swirling on around out there, and you can get your information from different places. And there's a lot of frustration when people think different ways. But maybe if we can just have a civil discussion about how we feel about things, maybe we can get over this a little bit sooner.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate your input and all of the research that you did for this. So that's it for this episode. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, comment, like, or send this episode to someone who might need to hear it. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society Emergency Fund for Journalists. Thanks for listening, and until next time.